ready to start this morning. Quarters at times seem like a lot to do yet, then all of a sudden you're at the end of the quarter, and seems like it's gone rather quickly. Now, let's say, first of all, I appreciate the opportunity to be with you this quarter. It's been very enjoyable. I've learned through my study, and I trust you have. Trevor, appreciate your work. He put a lot of work into this quarter. Just appreciate his work. Good job he did. And also on the administrative side, I've said a couple times, he took care of all the administrative work of getting the lessons, questions in, and made my life a little bit easier. So appreciate his work in that regard. And this morning, as we come to the end of this period, Sodom 400 years, we come into the time of the Roman Empire. What we've covered so far is up through the first three empires, in the time of the Maccabees. And now we come just a little bit beyond that, into the days when Rome becomes very prominent in the world. So as we start thinking about the Roman Empire, we need to go back again to Daniel 2. This is the very first passage I used at the beginning of the quarter. And I said then, I think it's one of the most significant prophecies in the entire Old Testament. In fact, you take the book of Daniel. The book of Daniel sets the pace for much of what we know, time-wise, regarding the beginning of the church. This particular passage, beginning here, especially verse 44, gives us probably the most significant link to set the timing of the birth of Christ and the beginning of the kingdom, because of this language. And so there's been a lot of emphasis. I've talked about it. Trevor's talked about it in two or three of his studies along the way. So it is very, very significant. It's one that everybody in the room probably already knows. If we don't, we need to be very familiar taking this passage, coming in the New Testament, and being able to link a few verses together to help people understand about the beginning of the kingdom. So if somebody asks you, you know, I've heard that you folks believe the church was established in AD 33. Where does that come from? Well, this is the basis for that right here. And that's not a real difficult question to answer. As long as you understand Daniel 2 and the links we'll look at this morning again as part of our review in the book of Luke. So this is a very key passage. If you know the book of Daniel is simply a prophetic look into the history of the nations. It would be a one-sentence summary of the book of Daniel. And it begins here in the second chapter. Now, we're not going to cover this in detail. We just notice that King Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon had the dream. And he said, God has given you a kingdom. There's the first kingdom of Daniel. After thee shall rise another kingdom in fear to thee. Which was which kingdom? What followed Babylon?
Medo-Persian.
All right. And another third kingdom of brass, which was Greece. All right. I highlighted this as well. Which shall bear rule over the earth. The nature of these kingdoms mentioned by Daniel, they're not just small powers that may arise over time. These are significant powers. So this phrase right here bears some significance right here. Even about Greece, Alexander the Great and that kingdom, shall bear rule over the earth. And the fourth kingdom that follows in succession shall be strong as iron. You come down to verse 44, and in the days of those kings, talking about the kings of this fourth kingdom, shall the God of heaven set up a kingdom which shall never be destroyed. Nor shall the sovereignty be left to another people, but it shall break in pieces and consume all these kingdoms, and it shall stand forever. So here is a kingdom that is distinct. The mere fact that he talks about four kingdoms says that what is not true about those kingdoms is this last statement right here. Now, they were not going to stand forever. That's why he noted four kingdoms. But now in the days of those kings, the Roman kings, there's going to be a kingdom established that is different in character. One primary difference is this phrase right here, and it shall stand forever. Now in the days of those kings, Roman kings, here's that phrase up here. Here are the verses right here. We'll talk about Augustus Caesar this morning. He began his rule in 31, reigned till 14 A.D. Now, what's significant about that is Luke chapter 2, verse 1. In Luke 2, we have the enrollment of Joseph and Mary. And if you look at the first six verses of Luke 2, there's the birth of Christ. And so we know that we place the birth of Christ in the days of these kings, that is, the Roman kings, based on Luke chapter 2. Another significant event in the days of these kings. Tiberius Caesar began reigning 14 A.D. Luke 3, it says, in the 15th year, of the reign of Tiberius. We do a little bit of math, about 29 A.D. And then it references John the Baptist beginning to do his work. So you place the work of John beginning in 29 A.D., Jesus shortly thereafter, and so you add 2.5-3 years to his ministry. Then you have Pentecost. Thereafter, you come to about 33 A.D. So that's why these verses are very important as we set the tone for the beginning of the kingdom and the birth of Christ. So it's a Roman Empire that we're talking about at this point in time. And from my standpoint, that's probably the most significant thing. It answers from Daniel who the fourth kingdom is, and it sets the timing for the coming of Christ and the beginning of the kingdom. Now, here is the Roman Empire. You'll notice here, we're going to talk about the first triumvirate in just a moment, 60 B.C., then Julius Caesar stand alone. It's interesting, as you study this, you start reading about people like Cleopatra. I say, wait a minute, what's that have to do with the Bible? Was she even real? Mark Antony, Julius Caesar, because all of us in school, apart from a biblical study, we read about Cleopatra and Mark Antony, and in your mind it can also be, well, did they really exist? Well, they were true. They were real people in history, and they're a part of this Roman history, and all of them play a very key role in some things that happened in Roman history. So you can see the Roman Empire was very, very expansive. That's what Daniel said. The extent of the empire would be greater than the others. Because you see it expand all the way to Spain, up into the area of Europe. So truly it became what Daniel said that it would be. Study like this, the key to being successful teaching is to deselect. So you've got time to cover material because there's so much. And so I've done that. Certainly there's a lot of details we could talk about, but certainly not time this morning. So I've tried to capture the salient points about the Roman Empire as it relates especially to the Jewish nation coming up to the first century. Early dates back to 753. The Punic Wars are significant. You come down to the boot of Italy, right across the Mediterranean Sea, you've got which continent? You got Africa, right? Carthage being the primary city. So you got these wars, three wars extended through that period of time. And they conquered Carthage, the city. It really took control of Africa during that period of time. So you see the influence and the expansion of the Roman Empire. You saw a moment ago on a map, expanding into Spain, up into Europe. And so by this period of time, the western part of the Mediterranean Sea was already under the control of the Roman Empire. Well, being a conquering empire, obviously they wanted to go further, right? Well, they couldn't go west because there was the Atlantic Ocean. So the only possible way to go was to the east. And so that's what they began to do. During this period of time, we left a lot of history out. By 75 B.C., basically Asia Minor was under the control of the Roman Empire. Now, as we've studied geography, important to us, it puts them ever closer to the land of Judea. Now, as we come to that, to Judea itself, Pompey, whom you study, Roman general, he finally makes Syria a province. Syria, during the days that we studied, would be synonymous with what power? The Syrians or the Seleucids, right. So that's very significant. So now the Greek influence and power has passed, even prior to this time. But now you've got Rome in control of Judea. And of course, that's going to continue for a good time. Another character we studied in school, Julius Caesar, another general in the Roman army. He's going west. While Pompey came to the east, Julius Caesar goes to the west. Goes up north, as we saw on a map a moment ago. So you see here are two powerful men, both military. And so at some point in time, you saw a clash, right, between these two. And certainly that's what's going to happen. Now before that happened in 60 B.C., Julius Caesar, Pompey, and Crassus, they formed sort of a triune, the three of them sort of ruling together. But that didn't last long. Crassus died, leaving Pompey, who was defeated by Julius Caesar in 48. So a period of about 12 years, there was some co-reigning with Pompey and Julius Caesar. But that ended in 48 B.C. Now we come to the Herod. We'll talk about more in detail in a couple of minutes. But here is Antipas, the son of Antipas, the first procurator, governor of Judea. And so he actually reigned during this period of time. He was appointed after the fall of Pompey in 48 B.C. So now we begin to see the influence of the Roman government in the affairs of Judea and of the Jewish people in Judea. 44 B.C., we studied in school, Julius Caesar assassinated by Brutus. But the control soon fell to Octavian and Mark Antony. Mark Antony, of course, is one who was coupled with Cleopatra, and you had that alliance in Egypt. So yeah, Mark Antony had control of the Eastern Empire that included Judea. So during the period of time, Mark Antony was the one who controlled Judea. And by agreement, Octavian controlled the western part of the empire. During his period of time, Herod the Great, he was appointed as tetrarch over Judea in 41 B.C. by Mark Antony. 37, we find that Mark Antony gave Herod the Great sole authority over Judea. We'll look at a couple more details about the Herods in just a moment. Again, you had two powerful men. Destiny was there for the two of them. Octavian defeats Mark Antony in 31 B.C. He's then given the title of Augustus. Again, very critical to us as we come in and make that link we talked about. Here's Augustus Caesar, referenced in Luke chapter 2. And as we saw, reigns of 14 A.D. So that's a very key link for a Bible student to recognize. So we read about Octavian. Finally, he now is named Augustus Caesar. Now let's switch now and talk about the Herods. There are various charts of the Herods. All of them are fairly busy because they show all the marriages, the intermarriages. Some of you know Mildred Perrin, who attended here for years. Some time back, she's down in Scottsboro. She wrote a good book. It's a booklet, actually, a very good one on the Herods. If you need an easy reference guide, I haven't looked for it in a number of years. CEI may still carry that or somebody. But it's a very good reference book that she wrote on the Herods. We're going to begin in just a moment talking about Antipater. Then we'll talk about Phaso and talk about Herod the Great. And that will be as far as our study goes because that takes us into the first century. Now, as Brent and the next class picks up, they'll be talking more about the Herods as we come into the New Testament study. You see some here. You know, you see Herod Agrippa and others that are on the chart. Agrippa here, Felix, Drusilla. So you see other members of the Herod family that will be very prominent in the New Testament story. But our time frame takes us really down to the time of Herod the Great. Now, we talk about the Herods. Trevor pointed this out. They were not Jews. They were Idumeans or Edomites. And so it's interesting that during a period of time, we have the Jews ruled by the Edomites. Now, what seems out of phase with that?
Blessing was given to Jacob, not to Esau.
All right, go back to Genesis 7. Blessing given to Jacob, not Esau. But the prophet said that one day that Esau would break the yoke. Many think this is a time when that happened. So here you've got the Edomites now ruling over the descendants of Jacob during this period of time. And Edom, of course, was down to the south of the Dead Sea, geographically. So it began with Antipas, who was a governor of Idumea, or the area of Edom, dated about 678 B.C., his son Antipas became procurator of Judea 47 B.C. We talked about that a moment ago. That was following the fall of Pompey, placed in power by Julius Caesar. So the Herods are very well placed. We don't have time to go all the history, but the Romans recognized that this piece of land was very critical because what other world power had risen east of Judea that Rome always contended with? The Parthians. Parthians were very powerful people, never conquered by Rome. So here was sort of a buffer zone, if you will, between the Parthians and Rome. So Rome was very concerned always about this area And they gave a lot of emphasis to the Harrons who were in power, lend them a lot of support during this period of time. So there was generally a pretty strong link between Rome and the Herod as a rule during this period of time on up in the New Testament times. So a fair amount of power was given to the Herods during this period of time. Hyrcanus served as high priest. Most think he was very secondary in power to Antipater during this period of time. Now, following the death of Antipater, Herod the Great and Phasael, two brothers, they followed their father basically as joint rulers. You can do some extra reading during this period of time. Herod the Great actually goes to Rome. He's actually appointed tetrarch in 41 BC by Mark Antony. He goes to Rome. Meanwhile, the Parthians, coupled with Antigonus, they sort of join forces. They come into Jerusalem. Phasael is put into prison. We're told that he committed suicide during that period of time. Perhaps by fate, Herod the Great had left Jerusalem, or he perhaps too would have been put in prison, but he was in Rome during this period of time. So we find that now his brother is now out of the picture. While he's in Rome, he receives sole authority over Judea by Mark Antony and Octavian. So that's how Herod the Great rises to preeminence. So now we look at Herod the Great in particular. So now we saw here's Phasael, here's Herod the Great. Phasael is sort of phased out of the picture. So now we've got Herod the Great. So let's take a look at Herod the Great. He ruled a long time. You think about some of the rulers, even King Nebuchadnezzar and some of the great empire rulers, he ruled for a significant period of time. It actually goes up before. So here's a 41-year span of time. So a long time span for anyone to rule in a particular area. But he returns back. He has the support of Mark Antony and of Augustus. And he's a very ruthless man. If you do any reading about Herod the Great, he's very, very ruthless. Even to his own family. One comment by the historian Josephus says he was equally brutal to all people. He showed no partiality. I'm not sure that's a good thing to have one say about you, but he was brutal to everybody, including his own family. So he was a very, very brutal man during that period of time. So he quickly eliminated the remains of the Asmonean house, which was linked to which family that we studied about? As a Maccabees, right? Now, the Jews, depending on which sect you were in and what part of history, there were some close ties, loose ties, but generally supporting the Maccabees because they had driven out Antiochus IV, who had oppressed them. So most Jews looked very favorably upon this family. Obviously, they were angered. He had a backing Mark Antony, so nothing came of that. But in the beginning of his reign, you had a conflict between himself and the Jews because of this particular point right here. He put to death his wife, we're told in about 28 BC, put his mother-in-law to death. Years later, put his two sons to death. So you get some insight into the man Herod the Great actually was. He was a man who was very political. We read about Herod's temple. He did rebuild the temple. Great splendor, didn't complete it, but he began a good part of that temple as he rebuilt that temple. Now, in my guest reference of Herod the Great, we come again into Matthew, the second chapter. Now, he's still reigning during this period of time. Jesus is born, the wise men go out, Matthew 2. They come back and talk to Herod. He's concerned about the power that this child may have, so he ordered the death of all male children. Certainly in line with his character that we've seen. And so we sort of leave Herod the Great right here in Matthew, the second chapter. You pick that up next quarter. But that's this man, Herod the Great. And we send a man to point in Herod. Antipas follows his father to power. This just shows the expanse of the kingdom of Herod the Great. A large area during this period of time. And the areas along the sea as well as in the areas the other side of the Jordan. So he had a fairly expansive kingdom during his reign as a Herod. Shift gears a little bit, talk about a few of the Jewish sects that appear. Now you're in a non-biblical part of history, obviously. But it's interesting to note because we do begin reading when the New Testament opens back up. Nowhere from Genesis to Malachi do we read about the Pharisees, the Sadducees, or the Zealots. They're not mentioned in the Old Testament. But almost immediately when you open the New Testament, they're there. They exist. You got the Pharisees, Sadducees, Zealots. These are groups that obviously evolved during this period of time. We mentioned that Sedum, all known as the pious ones, simply because, a couple of reasons. One, probably they have the origin of the Pharisees embedded in this. They were very strict from a religious standpoint. The other is, they were the ones that basically took the customs and made them almost law. Now that becomes important to our New Testament study. For example, Corbin. Children said, we don't have to take care of our parents. We just say it's Corbin. The washing of the hands, all of the rituals and customs that Jesus had to deal with. Many things that go back to this period of time. Today we have the Talmud. You may have heard about the Talmud. It makes one half of the Talmud. Basically taking all the instruction, all the customs, and almost binding it as law. And certainly we see the Pharisees especially doing that as we come into the first century. So we see the beginnings of this with this group. Then we have the Pharisees, placed by Josephus around 140 to 160 B.C. So the party of the Pharisees actually coming to power. They became opposition to Maccabees, while the Sadducees became supporters. So as you come to the New Testament, are the Pharisees and Sadducees close friends? No, they're not. They're antagonistic. From the very beginning, when you open the New Testament, but it goes back 100 and some years. And so you had those who supported the Maccabees, those who did not. And so you see this opposition begin way back at this period of time. So we see this happening. Oh, thank you. I don't know why I've got them up there. I never use them. You notice I lay them down just in case. Expensive glasses too, $14.95. I'm glad I appreciate that. All right. So strict keepers of law, as we know about, their political influence up and down, depending on who was in power at any point in time. So certainly, just a note, we can say more about the Pharisees, but the deselection process doesn't allow us to. The Sadducees, a little bit later, about the same period of time. They were the party of the wealthy, the influential. We're told that continued up to 70 A.D., when the city of Jerusalem was finally destroyed. So there was the conflict between the Sadducees, Pharisees. Many were priests. Josephus, the historian, was a priest and was also a Sadducee. If you want some good reading of a big book, get a copy of the History of Josephus and start reading. About this time next year, you'll complete the reading of Josephus. It's a large volume, but his writings are very, very important during this period of time. He was noted as probably the greatest Jewish historian. So much of the facts that we look at, quote, come from Josephus. Certainly a great work, very beneficial. So Sadducees, again, the concern about politics. As we see coming into the New Testament, they accept the law. Unlike the Pharisees, they did not accept all the customs and did not try to bind them as the Pharisees did. We're familiar with Acts 23:8. Did not believe in resurrection, angels or spirits, and the Pharisees did. So this is the two significant groups, the Pharisees and Sadducees, who came about. We mentioned the Zealots, not that influential through the years, perhaps not up until AD 70 when they became very antagonistic to the Roman government. But Simon the Zealot was an apostle of Christ. So we just mentioned that link. Perhaps the most significant thing about this group, the Zealots, they were nationalists. They sought the Jews as a nation once again. They were supported the year 1945 when Israel was once again recognized as a sovereign state. They would have seen this as a culmination of their work back 1900, some 1900 years earlier. Talk a little bit about the Sanhedrin Council, because we see it in a very prominent role in the New Testament. It soon became a ruling body, a court. Sort of translated court of justice. It is a Greek term. Some Jews today like to trace the origins of the council back to Moses, back to the days of Ezra. But we don't read anything in the Bible about that, so we cannot make that link back that far. You'll see, we'll mention about 56-55 B.C. So from a reliable standpoint, that's probably about as far back as we can trace the Sanhedrin Council. Through the year, we've heard of 70 members. Some say one more, one less. But about a 70-member council. Very powerful. Recognized by Rome. And they basically were given the primary control of this area of Judea in judging matters of law. So very powerful. Generally ruled over the high priest, certainly so as we come into the days of the New Testament. We see the Sanhedrin Council very much alive, very powerful. We see Caiaphas, trial of Jesus, Ananias at Paul's trial. So they are the high priest, they are the heads of the Sanhedrin Council. So it came about during this period of silent 400 years. Very powerful, very influential, recognized by Rome. A couple of restrictions beyond that, they basically controlled the laws and justice. AD 70, best information, had disbanded, never to exist again. So it ended when Rome destroyed Jerusalem in AD 70. Take a few minutes to sort of recap the quarter. It's a very interesting quarter of material because it covers not just a period of time, but a lot of different occurrences during this period of time. Some key lessons, there are many, 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 many key lessons. If you look at Trevor, he did a good job in most of his lessons, noting 10, 12, 15 key lessons that we can take away. So there are many, many takeaways from this quarter. I've only elevated four just because they are so significant. One is the idea of a remnant. And that's really what we began studying this quarter, that they would be carried into captivity. Assyria had already been carried into captivity, 721. Assyria. Israel carried into Assyrian captivity, 721. That had already taken place. Now that left Judah. But there was a promise, a number of promises. One, the seed promise. You had the nation promise fulfilled in Egypt. You have then the land promise fulfilled when they crossed the Jordan River. And Joshua led them in and they took the land flowing milk and honey. So you've got the land promise fulfilled. However, that left the third part of the promise made to Abraham of the seed promise. That in his seed would all nations of the earth be blessed. And so we've emphasized throughout this quarter, and even our children can understand how important this is as we weave this thread through this Bible story, that the remnant had to have been preserved. It was necessary for God to fulfill the seed promise that He had made to Abraham. And a part of that, as we've talked about, is the importance of the genealogies. So if we tell our young people nothing else about the genealogy as we come to them in our Bible, and it takes two pages, we don't always read over those two pages, we need to at least make this point very clearly so they understand how critical those genealogies were, even during this period of 400 years. And so the concept of remnant is very prominent in this section of Bible study, and we try to emphasize that. A first cousin with that is the fact that God keeps His promises. God keeps His promises. Whenever we see a rainbow in the sky, we should remind ourselves, you should tell your children every time you see a rainbow. Tell your grandchildren you see a rainbow every time. You don't see them that often, right? Rainbows a year, I think I've seen two this year that I recall. So if I've got children with me and twice a year I see a rainbow, that's not too often to remind them that, look, the rainbow is the only physical sign that God has given us. The only physical sign God has given us that He keeps His promises. We accept everything by faith, but never miss that opportunity. There's a rainbow and here's what it means, because it makes it significant here. We know God keeps His promises because you see the rainbow in the sky. And so God keeps His promises. Certainly God's control over nations is a prevailing point. We made it in the beginning and didn't make it after that. At least I didn't, because it becomes so obvious that God is in control of nations. He was then, He is today, and always will be. Now, to what extent and to who it is that God places in power, which nation God has raised up, is raising up right now, we don't know. But be assured through this study that God is in control. Spent some time this quarter talking about the premillennial theory. It's very important to combat error. You must understand some of the error that's taught, and especially with premillennial doctrine, because it is so prevalent. And it, compared to other doctrines, may be one of the easiest to confront, because you can take a body of 12 to 20 passages and you can dispel much of the premillennial doctrine. So that's been a point of emphasis throughout this quarter, with the key verse being Jeremiah 22 about Coniah, that never would one sit upon the throne of Coniah and prosper. We see the return from captivity. Did we have kings upon the return? No, what do we have? Governors under the control of the Persian king. And so we see the fulfillment of this passage. All right, let's take a few minutes. Sort of refresh our minds about what we've seen. Captivity of Israel, what year? 721. By which world empire? Assyria. Fall of Nineveh, what year? 612. Matt, why is it important to know the fall of Nineveh about 612? It sets the stage for what empire? Right. So you had the father of Nebuchadnezzar working during this time, influential in causing the fall of Nineveh, 612. So that's sort of an important date to us. The Battle of Carchemish, a little more obscure. Now, we mentioned not only the Battle of Carchemish brought which nations together in battle? Egypt, Assyria, and Josiah, right? Judah. But it marked the end of the nation of Assyria, basically. I mean, the power of Egypt during this period of time. And Assyrian, I'm sorry, marked the end of the Assyrian power at this point in time. And Babylon then becomes the power following this. Nebuchadnezzar's reign begins what year? This is a prominent date in history. 605 BC. His father dies, he begins reigning 605. The first group goes into Babylonian captivity what year? 605. He was there, right? He was there doing battle. His father dies, he goes back, takes some captivities, goes back. And so the first segment of captivity is 605 BC. Second group go to captivity what year? 598 or 97. Alright. King of Judah, when the second group is taken captive, he's known by at least three names. Okay, Jehoiakim, also known as Jeconiah or Coniah. And we pointed out before, this is important because you got a number of Bible statements that says, and this occurred in the fourth year of Jehoiakim, or the eighth year of Jehoiakim. So this date becomes important as we link things together. Now, fall of Jerusalem took place in what year? 586. So you got three phases, 605, 597, and 586. Now, who prophesied concerning the 70-year captivity? Which prophet? Jeremiah. We see that Daniel read about this, right? All right. And I was thinking Daniel, and she caught me on that one. Jeremiah 29:10. So I made a mistake here when I put this, when I wrote this down. Daniel was walking, and he read from Jeremiah. We see recorded Jeremiah 29, verse 10. All right. So correct that in your mind right here. All right. But Jeremiah 29:10 is a key passage because he prophesied about the 70 years. Daniel sees that prophecy, and he knows that the time is about to end, and then he prays to God during that period of time. The prophets during the period of captivity who were at least three. Isaiah, all right. At almost ended, you basically got Jeremiah, Ezekiel, and Daniel. Isaiah basically had finished his work, but Jeremiah prior to Ezekiel and Daniel during the captivity. So these three prophets. The ruler chosen by God to initiate the return from captivity. Cyrus. All right? And that's noted in Isaiah 44 and Isaiah 45, verse 1. And again, that's sort of important, isn't it? Hundreds of years ahead of time, God not only said it would happen, He said by name who it would be that would do this. Certainly a very key lesson for us. I gave that next one away, conquers Babylon in 539 B.C. Now that date becomes important. How does that link back to Jeremiah's prophecy? You're coming upon about how many years now? About 70 years. And so that's sort of important as we sort of make that link right here. All right, the first group returned to Judah in what year? The first group. 536. The leader of the first group. All right, Zerubbabel. Work, restored a temple in what year? All right, restored a temple 520. All right, what a trick question, Justin. It was completed in what year? 516, all right. Wasn't meant to be a trick question there. It started in 536. They come back, they're opposed, they stop. The work lies dormant for that period of time. Begins again in 520. Completed it in 516. Work on the temple completed. The two prophets encouraged the completion of the temple. On Haggai and Zechariah. During that period of time. The Persian queen deposed for refused to appear before the audience. Who was that, Jackie? Vashti. All right. The Jewess who became Persian queen. All right. Esther. Ezra returns to restore the law and worship in what year? I read some lists back there. He was right. 458. All right. The leader of this group was who? I'm sorry. The leader of the group returned to rebuild the walls. Was who? All right, Nehemiah. What year? 445 or 444. And you'll see both those years used. Who was a great Grecian king? Alexander the Great. What were the two significant Greek kingdoms following the rule of Alexander? All right, the Ptolemies and the Seleucids. Ptolemy started down in what area? Down in Egypt. The Seleucids up in the Syrian area. All right. Later, as you, the Ptolemies are overcome by the Seleucids. So as you come into that period of the Maccabean period, you find the Seleucids were then actually the reigning power. The group who opposed work of Antiochus IV, the Maccabees. All right. Name of Herod, who was ruling at the time of Jesus, and not Herod. Herod the Great, all right? All right, very good. Again, based upon Trevor's work and others of the deacons, all this has been captured, all the slides are out there. And the questions should be out there, minus what I did for today. I'll get those. So with all the information should be out there. Hopefully you have an enjoyable time, those who are teaching next quarter. And again, I appreciate the opportunity to be with you this quarter. All right.